world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like me. I'm Marlo Chastain from Rush County, Indiana. I'd like to give a shout out to my son, Ethan, for graduating as valedictorian of Rushville Consolidated High School. And we're proud. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. People who've found themselves with extra time on their hands recently have taken up some interesting new hobbies.
Also today, faith-based foster and adoption agencies face a new challenge to religious liberty in Michigan. Plus, the next installment of our story of community grief and recovery following a deadly attack.
One of the most beautiful things to me about this was watching how this community came together around these families. And it did not matter who was black or who was white.
And world commentator Ryan Bomberger on National Foster Care Month.
It's Tuesday, May 26th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Now the news. Here's Kent Covington.
The White House has announced that it's banning travel to the United States from Brazil. The move came just hours after National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien noted a worsening COVID-19 crisis there.
They're having a tough time with this crisis, and we're going to help them get through it. But in the meantime, it's likely that we're going to have to restrict travel from Brazil.
About 370,000 Brazilians have tested positive. That is now the second highest total in the world. The United States has five times as many confirmed cases, but U.S. health officials have conducted 20 times as many tests. That suggests Brazil may currently have the worst outbreak in the world. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has largely resisted coronavirus lockdowns, insisting that closing businesses will ultimately cause more hardship by wrecking the economy. The travel ban will not affect U.S. citizens returning home, and it's not expected to impact trade. President Trump had already temporarily banned certain travelers from other nations, including China and many European countries. But things are moving in the right direction in Japan. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is removing a coronavirus state of emergency from Tokyo and surrounding areas. World's Lee Jones has more.
Experts on a government-commissioned panel approved the plan to end a state of emergency that has lasted for more than a month and a half. That cleared the way for Prime Minister Abe to allow more businesses to gradually return to normal. Abe declared the state of emergency on April 7th. First in parts of Japan, including Tokyo. He later expanded it to the entire nation and extended it through the end of May. Japan's state of emergency is a soft lockdown. It's largely a request for people to stay at home and for non-essential businesses to close or operate shorter hours. The government will lift the emergency declaration in Tokyo and its three neighboring prefectures in the coming weeks. That will reopen schools and public facilities. Japan has a population of nearly 130 million people, but only about 17,000 confirmed cases. And despite a largely elderly population, it's recorded fewer than 1,000 coronavirus-related deaths. Reporting for World, I'm Lee Jones.
And in the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said his government is gearing up to reopen thousands of stores. Speaking to reporters at 10 Downing Street in London, he said it's another of Britain's, quote, careful but deliberate steps on the road to rebuilding our country.
We intend to allow all other non-essential retail, ranging from department stores to small independent shops, to reopen. Again, this change will be contingent upon progress against the five tests and will only be permitted for those retail premises which are COVID secure.
Outdoor markets can reopen on Monday. All other stores can reopen June 15th, provided they follow new guidelines. Johnson said he also wants to start reopening schools next month, part of a push to get more parents back to work and jumpstart the British economy. President Trump on Monday threatened to pull the Republican National Convention out of North Carolina. That is, if the state's governor can't assure the GOP that he'll allow large gatherings roughly 3 months from now, when the convention is scheduled to start. In a tweet, Trump said Democratic Governor Roy Cooper was still in a, quote, shutdown mood and couldn't guarantee full attendance in the arena where the convention is scheduled to take place. He added that Republicans need an answer immediately. Vice President Mike Pence later explained that the party needs a quick answer because party conventions take immense preparation and months of planning.
We look forward to working with Governor Cooper, getting a swift response, and if needs be, moving the national convention to a state that that is farther along on reopening and can say with confidence that we can gather there.
Before the pandemic, the GOP had estimated 50,000 people would come to Charlotte for the convention centered around its NBA arena. On Friday, Governor Cooper moved the state into phase two of its reopening, loosening restrictions on hair salons, barbers, and restaurants, but indoor gatherings are still limited to 10 people. A spokeswoman for the governor, Dori McMillan, responded to the White House on Monday, saying state officials are currently working with the RNC, but she made no assurances, adding, quote, North Carolina is relying on data and science to protect our state's public health and safety. For the first time in nearly a decade, U.S. astronauts are about to blast into orbit from American soil. A Falcon 9 rocket and Dragon capsule is slated to lift off tomorrow from Florida's Kennedy Space Center with two NASA astronauts on board, Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said a successful launch will mean Americans no longer have to hitch a ride on Russian rockets.
We've been buying Russian seats now for 9 years. And, you know, they started off at $20 million a seat. Now we're up to $90 million a seat. So this brings back an American capability to launch astronauts to space.
And for the first time in history, a private company is running the show. Elon Musk's SpaceX is the conductor and NASA is the customer. The astronauts will depart for the International Space Station from the exact spot where men once flew to the moon. President Trump and Vice President Pence both plan to attend the launch. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, pandemic hobbies, plus Ryan Bomberger on National Foster Care Month. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Tuesday, the 26th of May, 2020. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Nick Iger.
And I'm Mary Reichert. Well, today marks the end of season two of The Olasky Interview. We've brought you 12 of the best interviews by Marvin Olasky, past and present. So be sure to check those out.
Yeah, and especially today's final episode, we're finishing on a high note with Albert Mohler. You know him, of course, as president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And he does a podcast from time to time.
The Briefing. I love it. Yeah,
yes. But this interview took place just this past October in Asheville, North Carolina, at our most recent World Retreat. And you may recall Albert Mohler is a member of World's Board. He was so kind to come and address our staff and answer their questions, too. So you not only will hear Marvin Olasky's questions, but those of several World staffers, including some voices you've come to know, Megan Basham and J.C. Derrick.
Yeah, that was such a fun time. You know, back in the day when people met in groups.
Yeah, big groups, high fives, handshakes, all that stuff.
But it's different now. A whole lot has changed. Americans have spent a lot more time at home than usual over the past few months, aside from work and childcare and household chores. Some people are using their extra time to start a new hobby. Here is World Radio's Sarah Schweinsberg.
When governors began issuing mandatory lockdowns, most allowed garden nurseries to stay open. J&J Garden Center in Layton, Utah was one of them. Debbie Allred has worked there for a decade. She says the last 2 months have been unprecedented.
We've had actually about two and a half months of kind of Black Friday shopping every day. Yeah, we've actually emptied all our back greenhouses.
Across the country, gardening is growing during lockdown. University Garden Extension offices report a surge in calls. Garden bloggers I spoke with said they've had record numbers of website visits and book sales. One called Home Gardening with Pete saw a 200% increase in web traffic since March. J&J's Allred says many of the customers she helped had never gardened before. Some didn't even have yards.
I've helped a lot of people with living in apartments, and they just basically have pots to put their tomatoes. as well as planter boxes.
Novice gardeners like Kelly and Chad Denhartog in Iowa say gardening has been a fun way to fill extra time during lockdown.
Chad and I like to go out and do things on our weekends a lot. We don't have kids or anything yet, and kind of thought that gardening would be a good way to fill it up, and then you get to see the fruits of your labor, hopefully, in a couple of months. And
now, they're just waiting on their fresh ingredients for homemade salsa.
So I have tomatoes and peppers and jalapenos and onions.
Bread making is also proving popular during lockdowns. The evidence? Unprecedented demand for flour and yeast at grocery stores and traffic to bread making websites. Esme Williams is the head of predictive analytics for popular cooking website All Recipes. The site gets 3 billion visits a year.
So it's like having this really cool lens into American kitchens. We can really get a sense of what's happening.
Williams says over the past 3 months, what's been happening in the kitchen is bread.
So in April, views of bread recipes are up 385% year over year. Views of recipes that use bread machines up 232% in March. In April, that number was 404% year over year. So
one bread that has risen above the rest during quarantine is sourdough, which doesn't use yeast. Jim Challenger runs a smaller Instagram account dedicated to the fermented bread, but it's quickly growing.
I mean, I think I got 1,500 followers between last Friday and this Friday.
Emily Rafa also runs a sourdough blog. Her page views shot from 500,000 a month to 3.5 million.
As humans, we tend to go back to basics. And baking bread, whether you know how to do it or not, has been such a huge part of our society all over the world. You know?
Certain crafts have also taken hold. One perhaps unexpected winner? Candle making. Calla Hoover is a hairdresser in Salt Lake City. While she couldn't work, she took up the craft.
I was trying to think of something else that would be relatively quick to make that I could potentially use as gifts to give people throughout the year.
Candle making fit the bill.
I've been making really small candles. I've made maybe 300.
Knitting and crocheting have become other quarantine craft favorites. Jordan and Lindsay English own yarn manufacturer The Fiber Seed in Ohio. They've seen their online sales double since March.
The majority of the people who are buying yarn are not elderly. They're actually probably, I would say, in a range of like 60 down to 20. And it's a very vast and wide community.
Karen Hostetler runs Mountain Meadow Wool in Wyoming. Her online sales of knitting starter kits have also taken off.
I would say 5 months ago, we would sell maybe 3 kits a month. We are selling, you know, 200 to 300 kits a month now.
Tom Mavis is a marketing and consumer behavior professor at NYU. He points out all of these hobbies are hands-on in a time when we are forced to rely on technology for work, school, and social contact. Mavis says as people are forced to use technology, they long for physical objects even more.
So live experiences, tactile experiences, where you can hold something, when you can like hold someone, and that's being taken away. And so I think there's a greater need for these tactile, real experiences.
Christian von Uffel is a marketing and consumer behavior consultant. He says working with our hands also helps people relax and unwind. And while normal life is disrupted, hobbies give people something to discuss.
We don't have those normal things that we get to talk about, so we need to find social anchors to have conversations around.
So when life does resume its normal rhythms, will people keep up their newfound hobbies? Calla Hoover says her candle-making days are drawing to an end.
I have not fallen in love with it. I've enjoyed it.
But Kelly Denhartog says her gardening days will go on.
I've already really, really enjoyed it, and like going out and checking on them and seeing them grow or die. It's been fun.
Either way, everyone I spoke to said their new hobbies helped them through an unprecedented time. Reporting for World, I'm Sarah Schweinsberg in Layton, Utah.
Next up on The World and Everything In It, the religious liberty fight over foster care. In 2017, same-sex couple Christy and Dana Dumont sued the state of Michigan over its partnership with Christian foster and adoption agencies. The couple claimed the agencies discriminated against them because the agencies work exclusively with couples who can provide a home that includes a mother and a father. The legal battle that ensued over that continues today.
The eventual decision in this case and others like it could force a choice for faith-based agencies. Do they choose between their religious beliefs or helping to find safe homes for vulnerable children? Joining us with an update on where the case stands is Steve West. He writes the weekly Liberties Roundup for World Digital, and he is a fellow lawyer. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Mary.
Well, this case has had a lot of back and forth since 2017. Why don't you tell us a couple of highlights just for some context?
Well, sure. Well, back in 2017, when the Dumonts brought their lawsuit, the state worked with religious foster care agencies like St. Vincent Catholic Charities, which was the one involved here. It allowed them to refer same-sex couples who wanted to foster to other agencies. But then 2 years later, the state's position changed when Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Attorney General Dana Nessel took office.
And then what happened next?
Well, Attorney General Nessel settled the lawsuit. The state agreed to end contracts with religious foster agencies that wouldn't work with same-sex couples. And St. Vincent wasn't a part of the lawsuit. So then they faced a decision, either challenge the state's policy or close their doors to doing foster care. And they couldn't place children with same-sex couples because of their belief in biblical marriage. So a month later, then, St. Vincent sued the state, and it claimed that the Michigan non-discrimination law was in violation of their First Amendment rights, their right to free exercise of religion, and that their religion was targeted. And so a federal judge agreed with that and then entered an order blocking enforcement of the law until the matter could be tried. And that's where it stands right now.
Okay, so that takes us up through the last year. But then a federal appeals court issued a decision this month. What did that ruling say?
That decision by the Sixth Circuit was a procedural one, yet it shows how much is at stake here and how fierce the battle. The court allowed the lesbian couple that started all this, the Dumonts, to be a party to this action. In other words, to intervene so that not just the state would be involved, but them also.
Well, you know, that sounds an awful lot like political machinations as much as being strictly legal considerations. Steve, is this some kind of a contingency plan?
Well, it could be. The Dumonts and those backing them may be concerned that politics being what it is, the state could change its position once again after the November election. Neither the Attorney General or the governor are up for re-election this year, but Governor Whitmer has been floated as a possible running mate for Democrat Joe Biden.
And that is a big question, isn't it?
Huge. He has to pick her, and he has to win for her to be replaced. It's more likely that the legislature, which is in control of Republicans, could seek to take some action to constrain the Attorney General's position. And the other possibility is the Dumonts, who have already adopted through another agency, don't believe the state will be as aggressive in defending their position as they will. But again, it just shows how the battle lines have been drawn, not just for adoption agencies, but for religious people and religious organizations anywhere who are concerned about the breadth of these non-discrimination laws.
Well, this one is headed for the Supreme Court, which means I'll get to cover it next term on Legal Docket. Steve, tell us about the similar case the court has already agreed to hear next term.
Well, what happened in that case is the city of Philadelphia barred Catholic social services from placing foster kids because of their biblical beliefs about marriage. This, even though the city has a foster care crisis with 6,000 kids in care at any given time, the difference in this case is that the courts have not required Philadelphia to keep working with the agency while the decision is appealed. That means kids are getting left behind. But, you know, let's take heart. A friend of mine who heads an adoption agency told me recently, Christian families still want to adopt, donors still faithfully give, and birth mothers still want to make adoption plans. Lawsuits and rumors of lawsuits won't stop that.
Steve West writes the Liberties Roundup for World Digital. We'll link to his work in the transcript of today's program. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back, Mary.
Eight years ago, a woman in Johns Island, South Carolina, just down from Charleston, became the victim of a robbery. Someone had broken into her home, ripped out a lockbox, and made off with it. Police were never able to solve that crime. That is until a 6-year-old boy decided to go fishing. Specifically, young Knox Brewer took up a coronavirus lockdown hobby of his own, the hobby of magnet fishing, which involves literally dropping a magnet into a lake and hunting for metal objects that hit bottom. The boy figured he'd latched onto a big one because it would not budge, so he had to call for help. Eventually, he was able to surface that stolen lockbox. His dad called police. They, in turn, got in touch with the lady who reported the robbery 2 years before Knox was born. Most of the expensive stuff, sadly, was gone, but inside were some valuable charms from an old bracelet that she was pleased to have back. It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Tuesday, May 26th. We're so glad you've joined us today. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, moving forward after unimaginable loss. Yesterday, we began a four-part serial about a small Mississippi town with a dubious distinction. It was the scene of the largest mass killing in the history of the state. 8 people died at the hand of 35-year-old Corey Godbolt, but they were not the only victims. The killings shattered dozens of families. World correspondent Kim Henderson continues with their story.
Lincoln County law enforcement officers were familiar with Corey Godbolt. They also knew journalist Therese Apel. She cut her teeth there as a young reporter, and she was a friend of the slain deputy. So when she arrived at the crime scenes, officers let her move in close. But even she wasn't expecting what happened at her last stop.
And as I'm pulling up to 312 East Lincoln, I see him on his knees and getting onto the ground. 4 deputies around him. And he's not handcuffed yet.
Apel was the only media on the scene, and all she had was her cell phone. So she walked the perimeter, holding it down low, trying to get the lighting right.
I love my wife. I love my kids.
Audio here is courtesy of Apel and the Clarion Ledger.
They would not let me live and let live. I just want the love of my family.
Apel's phone was low on storage, so she was deleting pictures and apps as she went. She ended up with a string of videos and a full confession.
I wasn't afraid to face him, but there was this feeling of like it's in your chest. You just feel so little and so helpless and so unable to make sense of what's going on.
It apparently started as a family.
That weekend, as news of the shootings made headlines across the nation, I sent an email to my editor, Marvin Olasky. I let him know I'd live near where it happened. He wrote me back with a question that's rumbled around in my head ever since. How does such a small community deal with so much death? Lincoln County, Mississippi is rustic and rambling, with cattle auctions every Tuesday and a steady stream of 18-wheelers pulling out from the Walmart distribution center. The county seat, Brookhaven, has a thriving downtown area.
No matter which side of the tracks you live on or whatever like that, there's a real sense of community.
In the aftermath of the tragedy, expressions of grief in the community ran the spectrum. Residents covered the slain deputy's patrol car with flowers. Funeral goers filled and spilled out of the school gymnasium. A pastor led prayer in a driveway near one of the crime scenes.
In the hospital, God, you alone.
And Jesus, great.
The youngest of the victims was Austin Edwards, 11 years old. Just days before the shootings, he'd gone running with Corey Godbolt, a family friend and relative by marriage. Austin was excited. Corey had taught him how to manage his breathing while they jogged through the neighborhood down the street from the boys' church. A prosecutor would later point out the irony in court. Corey was the one who took Austin's breath away forever. Austin's mother, Shayla Edwards, remembers what it was like to shop for a suit to bury him in.
It hit me at that moment that this was the last time I'd be able to shop for my son. I just started crying and I couldn't stop.
A woman in the store
crying,
walked up to Shayla. She'd seen the story on the news.
And she stopped in the middle of what she was doing and she prayed for me.
Some in the community seemed set on revenge. Within weeks, Godbolt's home burned to the ground. But one potential source of conflict did not take root: racial division. Godbolt is black, and seven of his victims were black. The slain deputy was white. And this is 2017, the wounds of Ferguson and police deaths in Dallas and Baton Rouge were still raw. April says officers later told her they were glad she witnessed Godbolt's capture.
I didn't see one of them lay a hand on him wrong. I didn't see one of them even speak to him harshly.
Through her reporting, April told the world about a community grief.
One of the most beautiful things to me about this was watching how this community came together around these families. And it did not matter who was black or who was white.
Meanwhile, the tragedy took a toll on the families of the eight victims. Children were afraid to be alone. Parents were unable to work. Students dropped out of college. A mother moved away to escape the memories.
Sometimes I get up and can get dressed and I'm fine.
Shayla Edwards' sister, Tiffany Blackwell, also lost a son in the shootings. 18-year-old Jordan, a football standout who died shielding his cousin from bullets.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we could ask you to please pause for a moment of silence.
It has its ups and its down moments, but I just try to lean and depend on God to kind of just help me through it.
The murders happened in May. By that August, preacher's kids Shayla and Tiffany were ready to do something positive with their grief. With the help of a friend, they decided on a prayer group.
And we just sit out there and we pray.
They named it United in Christ Against Violence.
We pray for the children in the community, the teachers.
By the time the group got going, the TV cameras that had converged on Lincoln County after the murders were long gone. They missed those meetings. They missed the push to name a stretch of highway in memory of William Durr, the deputy who died. They missed Sean Blackwell's Facebook Live video, the one of him in the parking lot, praying before going into Godbolt's preliminary hearing. No, they didn't get to watch what was coming to the surface, but April did. God was bringing beauty from ashes.
Like, you couldn't have picked a more beautiful family for this to have happened to. I mean, we're all human, but it's like you see that smile on Tiffany and Shayla's faces, and you would never know the pain that they carry.
That might be the case, but Tiffany, Shayla, and their families would soon need all the support they could get to seek justice.
World correspondent Kim Henderson returns tomorrow with part three in our serial, A Community Grief. If you missed part one, you can find that at worldandeverything.org. Next time, tomorrow, a front row seat at the trial. Today is Tuesday, May 26th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Nick Iger.
And I'm Mary Reichard. May is coming to a close, and with it, National Foster Care Month. Commentator Ryan Bomberger says the plight of vulnerable children is worth highlighting all year long.
Children need a mom and a dad. That's the ideal, even if it doesn't always play out in real life. I was once a child without a mom and a dad. The first 6 weeks of my life, I was in foster care. Nine of my other adopted siblings were also in the foster care system, some as babies, some as toddlers, some as teenagers. And like all children in this flawed but vital system, each one is precious and deserving of love. I'm a firm believer that there is no such thing as an unwanted child. We're all wanted by someone. I was conceived in rape, yet adopted in love. The circumstances of our conception don't change the condition of our worth. And the circumstances that lead hundreds of thousands of children into foster care each year don't change the condition of their equal and irrevocable worth. In the latest report from the Department of Health and Human Services, there were more than 400,000 precious children in foster care in 2018. Each year, more than half exit foster care through reunification with biological families, adoption, and several other reasons. That includes a small percentage who tragically aged out of the system. There were just over 125,000 children waiting to be adopted as of September 2018. As a nation, we should be doing so much better. Out of an estimated 200,000 evangelical and conservative congregations in America, it would take about one family in one-third of these congregations to adopt to completely wipe out foster care roles of children waiting for forever families. As an adoptee and adoptive father, I must sound the alarm, not only because of apathy within the church, but a direct attack on it as well. As you heard earlier in the program, the LGBT movement has been trying to shut down faith-based child welfare agencies who believe in the biblical understanding of family with a married mother and father. In Philadelphia, Bethany Christian Services caved to rejoin the city's program and agreed to mandatory LGBTQ re-education training. That was June 2018. In April 2019, Michigan-based Bethany capitulated in its home state, agreeing to change its 75-year-old biblical policy and place children in same-sex homes. As a side note, I used to be a board member of several state chapters of Bethany Christian Services. I know there are affiliates who have not bowed to LGBT activism or changed their placement policies. Meanwhile, Catholic Social Services never gave up the fight, and its Philadelphia case has made it to the Supreme Court. Plaintiff Sharon L. Fulton is a beautifully compassionate woman who has fostered 40 children through faith-based adoption agencies. The court will hear her case in the fall. We need to pray for this case and for families to stand in the gap. Vulnerable children who've suffered neglect and abuse need love and healing in the best environment possible. They need permanence, not politics. I'm Ryan Bomberger.
Tomorrow, President Trump's judicial nominees are helping to reshape the American courts and not just the Supreme Court. We'll talk about that on Washington Wednesday. And we'll have the third in Kim Henderson's series on mass murder in small town Mississippi. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Gospel of John tells us the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Jesus came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Thanks for listening today, and please join us again tomorrow for The World and Everything in It.